Good evening. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 344, August the 11th, 1978, side one. Well, before I get too far into this, I want to apologize for this tape if the tape cassette is not the same quality as KLRB or the machinery. The last 2 weeks, the tapes were slow, and my tape cassette machine timing was off. I had had it in the shop to be repaired several times, and it broke consistently, and I borrowed a loan machine for making these tapes from the man who fixes my machines. It's a little bit scratchy. It's a Sanyo. It's supposed to do the job, but it'll be a little bit scratchy, and the speed for the last 2 weeks was too slow, and we tried to compensate it in getting it out to you. But what was normal, and what I taped at the house was normal, was off when it went to the tape center to be duplicated, and their machines are right, and mine was wrong, and I had to have it fixed. And that was quite disconcerting. I've gone through a series of things here at the house that have broken, machinery broken, and it goes in spells. I guess many of you know appliances and things do fall apart in spells. But everything at the house will break at one time, and it's a little disconcerting, particularly at first. I was only going to send one tape this week and not for the next 2 weeks while I was on vacation. And I decided to change my vacation plans because I was feeling insecure about having said too much about where I was going in advance, and got a couple of messages that made me feel that I should be a little more cautious about what I was doing. And also, there's a lot of material I wanted to get out, and I didn't want to lose those 2 weeks of time, because I do want to do a tape next week on Patty Hearst and one the week after on Evel Younger, and I don't want to wait so close to the fall to get into those, so I'll be sending those out. But as soon as I escalated my projects and decided what I wanted to do, my tape cassette didn't work, and I decided I had to leave that off, and I used my daughter's tape cassette, which has always worked. We recorded stuff recently, and the speed went around, and no sound comes out of it, and I left that off. And the copying machine, this last week, the thing, copies that I duplicate went fuzzy, and there's no exposure that fixes that. And my typewriter blocked, and we left it off where I always have the typewriter fixed, and in the shop it works fine. And when it comes back to the house, when I touch the tab to go back to the left column, the typewriter locks and doesn't work. It went in the machine shop a second time, and it works there, and nothing is wrong, and it comes back, and it doesn't work again, and then a third time. So I had the two tape cassettes broken, the typewriter broken, and decided in the copying machine. And then I'd ordered stationery with that World Watchers logo, the world, on it, and I waited 6 weeks. I ordered it in May. And waited 6 weeks. It actually took 7 weeks to come. And when it came, the little cards had that world on them. Some of you received those already, the little World Watcher International card. And the stationery had the logo of a ship, the nautical sign around, as if it was a yacht or something, around the circle, the nautical circle. And I looked at it, and I don't have a yacht, and it isn't what I ordered. And so they had to take back the 1,000 envelopes and paper and order a new World Watcher. And they looked in the book to see where they made a mistake, because the logo was the same for the cards and the printer was the same as the stationery. And they couldn't find anywhere in the books the logo for the nautical sign. And they don't know where it came from, but the nautical logo was on the stationery, and there was no explanation. But when all these things come down, it's time for May, you know, to relax, because in some way I'm getting a message, and I decide to take the weekend off and go to the psychic fair out at Asilomar, which coincidentally was happening just this weekend, and goodness knows it was time. Nothing around here was working, and I had all these tapes to get out, and there's a group called the Luxus Circle that has annual conventions, and they're going to be in London next year, and they were at Asilomar Conference Grounds. So I went out there and heard some fabulous lectures, and Friday night was Thelma Moss talking about holistic healing, which I'll give you a little bit of opinion on. I'm very much into holistic healing, and she works at UCLA. She's a PhD who's done the wonderful photographs of energy and the trillion photographs. She's been in the Soviet Union, and she works with the Russians, and she works in photographic energy and writing books on holistic healing. And along with her was Stephen Schwartz from Los Angeles, who has written a book on investigations of archaeological diggings used by psychics to find those particular diggings, and how psychics in Mexico and in Scotland and Ireland and Africa have led the archaeologists to buildings and architecturally rebuilt them and drew pictures of people that were buried in there literally 1,000 years ago, long, long time ago, and diggings a few hundred years back. They've been pretty specific, and he started out, Stephen Schwartz, working for the National Geographic, and was into these archaeological digs, and then met psychics in these various countries that led them, and got more into studying the psychic part of archaeology, and gave a fantastic slideshow on that subject. And then there's Marjorie Chomiak talking about dowsing. She's going to bring an instrument to the house, a dowsing instrument that she uses for energy fields. I am supposed to keep certain minerals in the house as counteracting what does supposedly to your body by using typewriters and copying machines and equipment around you all the time. I used to have some of those things that Wayne Cook had given me, and I haven't had them around lately. But she's coming to the house with a dowser, and then there was a gentleman, Hal Broda, who used to work for Dow Chemical, and he gave a lecture it wasn't Hal Broda. Hal Broda was on the haunted houses. It was Stephen Langer, who's into holistic medicine, who gave a lecture on Sunday morning, and he worked for Dow Chemical, and said that in the Soviet Union, in the United States, they are pretty advanced at making objects and clothing disappear. They asked me if I had things disappearing from the house, and I told them yes, and that I would always blame them on my daughter, Bonnie, who passed away when she was 14. It's sort of a family joke that Bonnie takes these sweaters or takes these pens and objects that once they go, they never return again. And they said that they experiment in the Soviet Union and in the United States in taking things, clothing and items away from people to disconcert them and to test their sensitivity and keep them off guard. And I remember when I was up in Canada on our property 7 years ago, it was this summer, and we'd been out digging clams and so forth, and we returned back to the tent trailer, and the middle of the floor was a nightgown that belonged to my daughter, who had died just 7 or 8 months earlier. Well, you can believe that's a little disconcerting, to be up at Vancouver Island and be out all day and living in a tent area where you've unpacked everything and find Bonnie's nightgown on the floor of the trailer. We have things that are left here and things that are taken, and this has happened to me continuously since she passed away, so you can see my interest in studying haunted houses. And I was talking to them early in the evening about the equipment here that isn't working, that's all breaks down at one time and jams. And the lecture that evening by Hal Broda Saturday night was investigating haunted houses, and he takes letters from different people and checks out particular houses and what they believe are ghosts in those houses. And he told about a woman that worked in an office, and no telephone system, Bell telephone or other telephone systems, could work. And wherever she worked with the telephones, they continuously jammed for no scientific reason, and they would change the whole phone system. And there was no way that when this particular person worked on these telephones that the phone systems worked. They worked for everybody else but couldn't work for her. And when he talked about that, these various people that had talked to me earlier looked at me because we were talking about the fact that my typewriter works in the shop and doesn't work at the house, and the recorder works out of the house and doesn't work in the house. And I'm too stubborn to move all of this stuff into different rooms of the house. I'm going to try and stay in the study where I am and find the answers, but it is something around me, and for me not to share it with you would be ridiculous. Thelma Moss talked about healing, which is very important. She's worked with Norman Cousins, who's had a treacherous disease where he was completely paralyzed and ready to die, a painful spinal disease, and he went about curing himself. And I have done a process of curing various diseases, from a multiple sclerosis in my sister-in-law to my own hay fever, and various I haven't done a lot of it for other people, mostly my own particular family around me. I wouldn't stand the risk of nosing into other people. I've had no training, but I've been very successful in handling diseases, and I was telling them that I would someday give a lecture at the group or talk or have a workshop on the specific things that I've done and how I've cured them and to help other people with those matters. We talked about angels, guardian angels. Dori D'Angelo talked about that, and she confirmed what I know, that I get a certain vision of people. It's like an arrow and a dart, like the angel Valentine concept, that I have to protect. And one was always Hugo Pinnell, who is in prison and currently serving a long sentence. And the other was Robert Hyde, and the other was Patty Hearst. And I always felt I could help those people stay alive. And Robert Hyde is out of the prison and very much alive and doing well. And Hugo stayed alive through the main era where he certainly was marked for death in the prison system. His buddy, Jeffrey Calden, a friend that I used to correspond with and tried to help, died last week at San Quentin Prison. He's very political. His wife was down in Cuba with the meeting that Fidel Castro had. And Jeffrey Calden is a father of four children and doesn't belong in the prison system. He's politically aware. Supposedly died by running into a wall when he was playing football. Then they said his head hit a pipe, but there was no blood on the pipe. The outrage in this country should be identical to the death of Stephen Biko in South Africa, but it's always easier to see things far away, and not much is written. He gives the name Katari. That was an African name he took, and I corresponded with him for quite a few years. He was very bitter about the way I was approaching my work and tangled and fought with me quite a bit, and I just didn't have the same determination that I had to guard over Hugo Pinnell. I didn't wish him harm, but I wished him well, as a matter of fact. But I always had a complex about being here to help Hugo and Robert Hyde and Patty. Of course, 4 years ago, I wrote the article, The SLA is the CIA. A year ago, I had called her priest, Reverend Dumke, and pleaded to help them. And he said he lost the article. And just last week, somebody came to Patty Hearst and said, May Brussel can help you. You should get in touch with May. And she told her priest, and he said, I'm in touch with May. And the tape next week will be on Patty Hearst and the protective shield of how to protect Patty Hearst at this time, and an update of my SLA article. I think I can save her life if they will do the things that I'm telling them to do, and I've made out a program. So we talked about angels at the meeting, and one of the interesting parts of this psychic fair or meeting that the Luxus Circle had, again, was the description of Stephen Schwartz using psychics to help locate a ship in Catalina Island off Los Angeles. And they used three psychics to ask, what would you find if we went down here? And each one didn't know each other and was not familiar with the area. And they locked their findings, I think, in the, either Berkeley or Harvard Library and kept them with somebody. And each one was separate, not working, as I say, with each other. And one described a Y-shaped object and the other a square block object. And they described where a ship was located. So they took a ship leaving off near San Diego at opposite Catalina and took a small submarine with a large crane that digs up objects and a glass wall. And it shows these various people and Mr. Schwartz down in the ship. And they brought up this large Y-shaped object that was filled with barnacles about 90 years old and a huge square block of concrete about 6 feet square that I don't think they could get out with the instruments they had. And they did find a ship that was about 90 years old that had never been recorded in any history book, or they had no knowledge of it in the area. And he believes strongly in the use of psychics to do research into archaeological diggings. Now, you may wonder, with this long introduction, why psychics have anything to do with, say, political assassinations. But there's one thing that I have to make clear for those of you who don't know me or be a little shocked by my saying it, sometimes people are, is that I believe in these psychic phenomena and that I had never read a mystery story or owned a book, a mystery story, until John Kennedy was killed. And the only psychic phenomena that happened to me was some kind of a voice that when we were in India, and I was just about to turn 15 years old, I was 14 plus, about 2 weeks before my birthday, and we took a trip around the world and we were in India. And I saw all these people on the streets lying down at night with no home and just Bombay and Calcutta, and it really affected me deeply. And I don't remember then whether it was a voice or whether I was just talking to myself, and I said, you're going to do something to help people someday. And I didn't know what it meant. It was very ingrained into my head, and I was going to Beverly Hills High School at the time, and I already knew that in a couple of years I really wanted to go to Stanford. And I really didn't have any goals. I wasn't politically into the Cold War period. I wasn't interested so much, even when I was married and had children, into the Rosenberg case, the Alger Hiss. And I was mostly just concerned with my own family, my own immediate children, and husbands. I had two by 1952, 53. Been married twice. And I just went through school and didn't know what the calling was. But in the back of my mind, there was some kind of a message, and I can't really translate it, except I thought it was terrible. But I had no direction and no guide, and then with the day that John Kennedy was killed, I watched the television and followed the news and felt pretty badly. We'd taken the boys to see the nomination speech of John Kennedy down in Los Angeles at the Coliseum. And the day, 2 days after John Kennedy was killed, November the 24th, 1963, Jack Ruby plunged forward and killed Lee Harvey Oswald. And it was then that I got a flash, I guess what you would call a psychic flash, and it really scared me. And I remember what I did. I left the family room where we were watching this phenomena, and I went to the telephone, and I called my father, and I don't know why, but I just did, and I said, I broke down the conspiracy and what I thought had happened, and that Jack Ruby was involved and that he worked with these racists, and the racists would link to Adolf Hitler and the Nazi connections, and that the world would be in turmoil because of what Jack Ruby did, and that I was really terrified, and all of a sudden I had these five children and a family, and it frightened me terrifically. And Jack Ruby had been arrested. They picked him up right away, and there was a lot of commotion, and many of you have reconstructed the tapes or the books of those moments, and they said, who is he, who is he? And there was a scrambling in the Dallas jail, and there was a comment, oh, you know Jack Ruby, he's a police buff, and he's been around the police department, and somebody even said he had been arrested once for illegally having weapons. It's funny that they recognized him for that, and he'd still been in the jail, but he went down the ramp so fast that even that person might not have even seen Jack Ruby in the crowd. But what I heard when I watched this altercation of Jack Ruby with Lee Harvey Oswald, I heard the sentence on the TV or in my head say, Jack Ruby was at the home of H.L. Hunt the afternoon of November 23rd, 1963, from 2 to 5 o'clock, either 3 to 5 or 2 to 5. And I checked the ABC News and the CBS and the NBC and all those people that have taped the assassination news since the day John Kennedy was killed, and nobody else ever heard that. And that had to be a psychic calling to me, go after that lead, because no one else, as I say, I don't know of any other person, and I'm putting this out for you to research or investigate, ever heard that before. And it stayed in my head, and I began to collect newspapers on the assassination. And the Warren Report came out in September of 64. I increased my subscriptions to newspapers. And then I bought the Warren Commission hearings, and my husband gave them to me for a Christmas present. And in December, they came out in 64. And the 26 volumes came out. Oh, I mean, they were goodies. They were brand new and bound and tight. Now mine are all threadbare and underlined and marked all over. And I opened up volume 9, I didn't know where to turn first, and that was a testimony of George de Morenschild, who had praised Himmler at the Petroleum Club in Texas, and later Jean de Morenschild this year said that her husband was a close friend of H.L. Hunt, the oil man. She testified, I understand, in Washington, D.C., that he was close to H.L. Hunt, the oil man, and he also was the man who visited Lee Harvey Oswald Marina first when Oswald was away and made her acquaintance with Colonel Lawrence Orloff, and then became the CIA babysitter of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And his wife, Jean de Morenschild, was brought over here by the Howard Hughes Organization, and her husband worked for the CIA. Her daughter was married to the son of Vice President of Lockheed, and the rest is history in terms of the way I began to pursue my work. But as I went through the testimony of the 26 volumes all those years, I think it's sort of interesting to dwell on the psychic lead I got and how it's been handled in the past 15 years in terms of evidence, because I think that psychic work can be done in terms of the assassinations, and I'll write it up someday, just as Mr. Schwartz is doing with psychic archaeological diggings. The same way, after the accident at Chappaquiddick, we were camping down at Big Sur campgrounds, and I called Mrs. Kopechny and told her, before the fingerprints get too dry, fingerprint the steering wheel, that Ted Kennedy wasn't driving the car was overturned, that he was given a substance and made drowsy and was asleep and removed from the car and didn't drive it, and Mary Jo was asleep in back of the car. I didn't know who turned over the car, who drove it over the edge, and I said, have an autopsy, there'll be chemicals in her stomach. And Mrs. Kopechny said to me, well, why are you telling me this? And I said, well, they're using this excuse to keep Ted Kennedy from running for president in 1972, and your daughter is a selected patsy, and that she's identical to Officer Tippett in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, who had to be murdered in excuse for arresting Lee Harvey Oswald immediately after the assassination and bring him in on something so that they could then shoot him in the custody of the police department. And everyone seeing the shooting right there would say, well, how could it be a conspiracy? We all saw it in front of our eyes. Mrs. Kopechny didn't have an autopsy. She didn't ask for one. A few years later, just a year or two ago, she said the one thing she regretted was that she never had an autopsy of Mary Jo Kopechny. And I believe that some substances are not traceable in the body, but then again, they might be. And because she had blood on her blouse and shirt that couldn't have been received from the drowning, they should have demanded an investigation along the lines that I suggested. But of course they didn't, and that is history. But what about Jack Ruby? I wanted to talk about Jack Ruby and the testimony from the Warren Commission hearings. And if any of you have anything to add on this in your research, by all means, send it to me. There was the testimony of Mr. Rossi in the 26 volumes that Jack Ruby was in the building and the office of H.L. Hunt on Wednesday before the assassination. He had, in fact, been at the office of Hunt on Wednesday before. There was evidence that he was accompanied. He took Connie Trammell to H.L. Hunt's office. That was the excuse of being there. Connie Trammell was a college graduate who came to Ruby's club for just a very, very short time and went on to work at the Republic National Bank, I believe located in Houston, Texas. And Jack Ruby drove her to H.L. Hunt's office on Wednesday. And Connie Trammell's bank was identified in 1967 at the time of the exposures of the foundations and the CIA as being a source of, in quotes, black money, which is killing money. It was an outlet for paying intelligence jobs, and she worked there. And Connie Trammell had contact to Volkmar Schmidt and Larry Schmidt, the men from Munich, Germany, the 17, 18 men that came to the Dallas-Fort Worth area under the auspices of attorney Robert Morris, who used to work with Richard Nixon's House Internal Security Committee. And they also infiltrated what was set up as the Young Americans for Freedom, which was started by Douglas Caddy, who worked in the Watergate offices of Mullen. They were exposed at the time of Watergate and formed it with William Buckley. And, of course, you know the long association of E. Howard Hunt, his links to the assassination teams, and personal close work in the CIA with William Buckley. Connie Trammell worked with these people, and she worked with Jack Ruby and was at the office of H.L. Hunt. When Ruby was arrested, on the seat of his car was literature written for a program, Lifeline, that H.L. Hunt put on the air in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and all over the Southwest. And Warren Carroll wrote this material for Lifeline for Hunt, and he also was identified as working in the Central Intelligence Agency. And on the seat of the car were commercials written into the program. It wasn't a program that Jack Ruby could pick up just anywhere. They wanted to know if he got it at the fairgrounds, at the county fair, just prior to the assassination, and there was no way. And this literature was, the whole pitch was, be a hero, come on, be a hero. And someday I'm going to write about the mind control of Bernard Weissman and Jack Ruby, the two Jews, used as a front for the far-right wing assassination conspiracy team. The anti-Semites selected Rubenstein and Weissman as the front man to hide their anti-Semitism. There was a man testifying before Congress this week, a hit man for organized crime and who did various work for members of organized crime and trafficanda, and he mentioned that when they did arsons or did hits, they left names of other blacks, as if blacks did it, or radical left, to hide where the source of the crimes were coming from. And it was this way the Kennedy assassination employed these two Jews. So Jack Ruby was at the office of H.L. Hunt, and he was accompanying Connie Tramiel with her links to the CIA. He had literature on the seat of his car from a man linked to the CIA and to H.L. Hunt, and George de Bornschild had contact with Hunt and Lee and Marina Oswald. So the psychic view that I had, that he was, Jack Ruby was with Hunt, needed further examination. And in the testimony of Jack Ruby in Volume 5 of the Warren Commission hearings and in Volume 14, they account in questioning for Jack Ruby for every hour that from about Friday afternoon until Sunday when he was arrested, except for those very hours that I heard. It had to be psychically, because right then I had those dates and that name to go for my research, and the Warren Commission skirted around everything except that area. Now, one way they handled this, I want to read to you. Some of you have the 26 volumes, but most of you can't get it, and I think it's good to read it with you. It's from Volume 14, and the testimony was July 18, 1964. The way the wording went with Jack Ruby about the plans to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, to show you how they circumvent the area which I was told to follow through whatever source it came. I'm only the medium by which it came. I pass it on to you for whatever it's worth. But I want to read this to you. I wrote a play called Tiger by the Tail, and it's never been put out yet, and I think it's really good. The first act is Jack Ruby with Earl Warren, Leon Jaworski, and Gerald Ford. And the second act is the polygraph test of Jack Ruby sparring with the Dallas officials, the federal officials, writing his own questions and working with the Warren Commission in a way that he probably felt that he would finally be released later and get a fair trial. And present at this polygraph test was Arlene Specter, the same Arlene Specter that's running for governor of Pennsylvania now. And the whole text of what I'm going to be reading to you, this section from Volume 14, has to do with foreknowledge of the assassination, and is it possible that he was talking to H.L. Hunt about killing Lee Harvey Oswald. Arlene Specter created that famous Bullet 399, that hogwash of ballistic misinformation, and he represents the Warren Commission at this little section I'm going to read to you. And then there's Bell Hurdon and W. James Wood, agents of the FBI who are to give Jack Ruby the polygraph test. Clayton Fowler is the attorney that Jack Ruby took on at this time for the polygraph test, and he's in the room with him. And Joe Tannehill is a wealthy oil man who always was in the cell with Jack Ruby wearing a gun, and Ruby tried to get him out, always kicked him out. They said, you don't have the mental judgment to get Tannehill out of the room. Tannehill represented the oil people and the oil interests and was always present. And Ruby said he distorted things and lied about him, and he said, you're not my lawyer. And the Warren Commission and the federal agency said, well, being as you're crazy, you can't decide to fire him. And the basis upon which he was crazy was that he shot a man on national television where everyone saw him, and therefore he was crazy. And William Alexander's in the room. He's the assistant district attorney for Dallas County. And Alan Sweet, a criminal deputy for the Dallas County in Texas. And Holman was the chief jailer. And Dr. William Beavers was an observer in the room. And I'm going to just show you how the Warren Commission and Jack Ruby were able to cover up any possible links to when Jack Ruby might have planned to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. This is, as I say, Volume 14. Mr. Hurdon, who's giving the polygraph test, said, we'll proceed to what we call Series 3. Here the questions are intermixed. Some are pertinent and others aren't. And this is the question he asked them. Between the assassination and the shooting, did anybody you know tell you they knew Lee Harvey Oswald? Now, up to that point, they said, were you born in Chicago? He said, yes. Did you ever make a false statement on a legal application? He said, no. Were you born in 1911? Yes. So then, we'll turn this side over now. We're just about at the end, and then I'll get into the interview of Jack Ruby and his polygraph test on his foreknowledge of the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald.